Good afternoon, Eastern Washington. This is Matt Shea, and welcome to Patriot Radio, broadcasting live from the Capitol, Olympia. Brought to you once again by the committee to elect Matt Shea Republican and legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. And once again, this is the year we do the hard work to implement freedom, because our hope is not in man, our hope is in Jesus Christ. And we can't end in prayer, we must also move to action. And as Exodus 15:3 states, the Lord is a warrior, the Lord is his name. Are we warriors? That's the question. Are we warriors? I've been thinking about a lot of things coming up. This week we're in Olympia, third special session, approaching 4th of July weekend, and I'll get to some of that here in a bit. And I got a great guest on the show today, by the way, that is going to be talking about the Shroud of Turin and a conference that's actually coming here to Washington State. So we got more on that. I don't want to spoil it all, but we got more on that coming up. But it got me thinking about everything that's going on right now and kind of what the missing piece is. You know, a lot of us have thought for a long time things have been headed in the wrong direction. I've mentioned Sir John Glubb and the fate of empires and the fact that the cycle of empires for us comes up in 2025, that the fourth turning and the study of generations, that also comes up in the same time frame. And this idea that we are approaching a point that's kind of a make or break point for the values that we hold dear in this wonderful experiment here in America. And what's the missing piece? And I've been really looking at this for a long time, because a lot of us have been walking in truth. There's no question about it. We've been walking in truth. We've been trying to preach truth and love, talk about the truth of our Constitution, the truth of our founding principles, fundamental principles, specifically freedom and liberty, and the idea that government was supposed to be small. And there's a lot of emotional attachment still to the old system, in the old system being the system of this gigantic bureaucracy, that government really has to do all these things in society. There really is this emotional attachment to it. A person I've known for almost 2.5 decades tried to challenge me on the idea of the 51st state and the idea of some of these fundamental principles. And it was an emotional argument. And when I called them on it, they said that was insulting them. And I realized that we are, as Christians, a lot of times we're missing one key component. We've walked in truth, we've walked in love, and then it seems like there's this veil over some other Christian's eyes. And for those of you out there listening, you know what I'm talking about. It's like you're talking to Christians, and they're missing something, and then they lash out at you. They lash out at what you're saying to them. They lash out at the idea that you can have a discussion with them over these things, these fundamental ideas of principle. And specifically with the 51st state, it's bringing this out, this idea we can never split from anything, that splitting is bad, that paring a system down, dramatically reducing the size and scope of government, these are all bad things. They look at it as almost as if it's some sort of a divorce. And to a degree, it actually is, in that it's splitting from irreconcilable values. And Seattle has totally different values than we do in Eastern Washington on many different things. And for those of you that have listened to this show or seen my presentations, you know that. But anything that talks about splitting for the good of preserving America, preserving those fundamental principles, there's this emotional attachment to the old ways. And I've seen this among Christians particularly. And as I've told many of you before, some of the worst audiences I've had to speak in front of are Christians, because some people are not humble enough to say, I don't know what I don't know. And that's a very humbling statement to make. So what is this missing piece? And the missing piece is the Spirit. We have people walking in truth telling truth, preaching truth in love, but they're missing the Spirit. And Scripture is very clear that we're supposed to worship in spirit and truth. And the Holy Spirit lifts the veil from our eyes, guides us through the minefields that we're seeing, but also allows us, very clearly allows us, to see things in a way that God sees them. Because we can't do that in our own strength. And so when I'm talking about some of these things and the idea that we may be coming, especially in Washington State, to an Israel-Judah moment where you have half the state, and these are obviously rough numbers, half the state that wants to follow truth, righteousness, and the Lord, and half the state that wants to go a different direction, that you're not going to necessarily reconcile those things, and that a split actually may be the exact right thing to do to preserve liberty and freedom and Christian principles in perpetuity. And Article 1, Section 32 of the state constitution is very interesting because it says there must be a frequent recurrence. You can go read this for yourself because it's an affirmative duty to every single person in Washington State. There must be a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles in order to keep freedom for generations to come. And I think we're at a point where we got to make a decision. I mean, we are not represented by Seattle. They trump us in everything. They don't share our values in many, many things. Fine, let them do their own thing. But as for us, we're going to follow the right path. And so we can only do that, though, if we have the Spirit, if we're walking in truth and in the Spirit. And I know there's a lot of you out there that this is going to resonate with because you're like, yes, that's it. You put your finger on exactly what the issue is. Because I've had these conversations with fellow Christians, and they cannot seem to get it. They get caught up in process. They get caught up in the way things look in form, but they're not looking at the substance of things. And you just, it's exasperating to you because you keep talking to them, and it can't seem to make any headway. And that's because the missing piece is the Spirit. And I think that is what is beginning to revive in different places, but specifically in Spokane. There has been a massive movement of the Holy Spirit recently, and I am just ecstatic to see it because I think that is what is going to help solidify in Christian minds what we are supposed to be doing in this time. And for those that just don't want to hear it and aren't humble enough to say, I don't know what I don't know, then yes, they're going to continually be at odds with you and continually try to define God according to the way that they think God should be instead of the way that God actually is. And the only way that we can know that is through the guidance and direction of the Holy Spirit. And it's a simple principle in Christianity, but I'm telling you, I have seen it, especially in the last couple of months, people missing this point, this key point. And it really is the source of a lot of problems inside the church right now. And that brings me now to your daily intelligence briefing on the international front. So this continued reign of terror across Europe, and I mean, we're literally seeing terrorist attacks, you know, once every couple weeks now, once every week. And it's going to continue, and it seems like the people that are in charge over there, particularly Angela Merkel, who know that the cause of this is this massive unvetted influx of these refugees, aren't doing anything about it. And they don't want to do anything about it. They basically say, we just got to live with it. And they're reaping what they have sown over there. And if you don't think that there are, you know, terror cells already in the United States, there are. And we need to be ever vigilant. And we need to have leaders who address that head on. And it looks like, to a certain extent, Trump is. But one of the things that he really needs to do is designate the Muslim Brotherhood and all of its subsidiary organizations in the United States terrorist organizations officially. And we all know it's a terrorist group. We all know that. I mean, just the study of history, we know that. But we need that official designation here in America. Also, on the international front, the massive buildup in the Middle East continues. The battle in Syria is now raging near the Israeli border. And very interesting how all of that's shaping up. Now, there's a lot of things in the news that you have not been hearing. Iran launched missiles into Syria near U.S. positions. Also, the United States shot down a Syrian jet. The Russians specifically said that they were going to increase their surface-to-air missile defense systems in Syria. You have the United States now actively helping the Kurds to consolidate. At least that's the way it appears by all objective standards. And being with the Kurds in the north, both Syrian, Iraqi, and you also have Kurds in the northern part of Iran, and you also have Kurds in the eastern part of Turkey. And that forming a new country really looks like the direction is something that is not in the news. Is apparently on July 25th, there's actually going to be a vote on this. And this is specifically in Iraq for the Iraqi Kurds. But how many of you have heard that that's happening? That's a profound change in the Middle East if another nation is birthed in the Middle East of Kurdistan. And I think what we're going to continue to see is a lot of upheaval there, even though it seems like ISIS is being completely defeated. Clearly, they are not if they're spreading throughout the world. And I don't think people are understanding the nature of the evil that we face with an organization like that. And look, I'm very well versed and understand all of the implications on how ISIS was allowed to exist and be created. I understand all of that. But the fact of the matter is, they really represent a clear and present danger to the United States of America, and they represent evil. And ultimately, we're going to have to fight that head on. And I know the Trump administration is trying to do that in the Middle East by going on the offense along with Mattis. But we don't hear a lot about it, and I think there's a lot of people that don't take it as seriously as it should be taken. Also on the international front, Korea looks like we're on the verge of a sixth nuclear test for Korea, North Korea, that is, and with three aircraft carrier groups in the region now. The last time that happened, that boded that there was war in the offing. Keep your eyes on North Korea. That situation literally could change in a minute. Also, understand something that Seoul, South Korea, is one of the larger manufacturing hubs in the world, and that if something happened, if war broke out there, and Seoul, South Korea was impacted, even slightly, it would have profound economic ramifications throughout the rest of the world. So again, keep your eye on this whole situation on the Korean Peninsula. It seems like it continues to escalate, although you're not seeing it a lot in the mainstream media. Also on the international front, Venezuelan civil unrest continues to grow. More deaths, continued protests in the streets of Venezuela. It is really coming to a head, and looks like it's going to continue to escalate into full-blown civil war down there after this the failed policies of socialism again result in bloodshed. Folks, people said again that this could never happen in such a large oil-rich country, and yet it has. Horrific stories coming out of the prisons in Venezuela, everything from cannibalism to the eating of human fecal matter, and just horrific things. I know that's gross, but folks, I think we have to look at it because that is the logical conclusion of socialist policies. And the more we allow anything akin to that here in the United States of America, the more we put ourselves in jeopardy that we're going to go down the same roads, which brings us to the next thing. And I want to go down really quick on the national front and mention this. But think about Illinois and Puerto Rico, and I'll get to that here in a second, because those are the results of failed socialist policies. Lastly, on the international front, driverless mini cop car is going to Dubai. I talked about the first robot cop being there in Dubai. Then they're going to have the first flying taxi debuting this summer. Also, now a driverless mini cop car in Dubai as well. So going completely automated on the forefront of it. And for those of you that thought this would never happen, it was way off into the future. You need to read about Moore's Law. You need to be really well-versed that a lot of these things are going to happen so much faster than we can even imagine. Within the next 2 years, drones landing in your front yard delivering packages, automated cars on the streets of the United States of America and Washington State, and a lot more things. People increasingly going to online learning with digital capabilities that allow you literally to have a teacher for any subject matter you want that's an expert and a good teacher there, and you can learn at home. And people are going to be like, why are we sending our kids to school when we can do everything at home? We don't have to worry about vaccinations. We don't have to worry about school shootings. We don't have to worry about all of the social pressures and things that tend to stray kids in the wrong direction. Don't have to worry about any of that. Just at home. And then maybe you go down to a sports complex once a day for soccer practice or baseball practice. You know, or you have a central building for shop or labs, and that's it. That's the only brick and mortar. And so there's going to be increasing move toward that too. We got to think all those things that were way, way out there are now rushing toward us. And the reality of the technology that we are going toward is going to profoundly change the way that we live. Also on the national front. So there's the S&P downgrade of Illinois to near junk status. They are in, quote, crisis mode in Illinois right now. This is following the heels of Puerto Rico declaring bankruptcy, then voting to become the 51st state, which I do not think Congress is going to approve. But the fact of the matter is that Illinois, a very large state, read Chicago, okay, a very large state, literally is in crisis mode for their budget and looks like they are going to implode financially. Now, again, these dominoes start, and where do they stop? You know, who's next? California? But they again highlight the fact that these socialist policies eventually have a day of reckoning. Most profoundly, going back to Venezuela briefly, when Venezuela ran out of money to buy the materials to print more money. Now, some people say, well, we just go to digital currency. Okay, fine. So you have to still have money to have server farms. You still have to have money to have people to operate those things and to continually check the code and check the validity and the veracity of the currency. So similar to mining Bitcoin, obviously. And you have to have money to do that too. So there's always a point of reckoning of reality with these socialist policies. Where does it end? Where does it end? Also on the national front, very interesting story in regards to CNN. So CNN gets caught, and once again, Project Veritas and O'Keefe doing just a phenomenal job. CNN, one of their producers, admits, and this is on camera, admits that the whole Russia story with Trump was, quote, and I'm going to abbreviate this, BS just for the ratings. Wow. So they're admitting literally that the whole thing is just smoke and mirrors. There's nothing to it. So check that out online if you haven't already seen it. But it just another reason the mainstream media gets called out and just loses all credibility again. And, you know, another reason people are just going directly to social media and other sources because it's just far more accurate. And I know there are problems with social media. I get that. But compared to this intentional use of media to mislead the American people, I think people should have the ability to verify facts for themselves because it is a far better way to get news now. Also on the national front, CNN admits the existence of geoengineering. Finally! You know, we had talked about this. We had a scientist who actually worked on geoengineering in the 1960s during the Vietnam War come on the show. I mean, this is not, you know, some hidden secret or something, but nobody would touch this with a 10-foot pole until NASA said they were going to launch a rocket, and they admitted that the rocket's purpose was geoengineering on the East Coast. And so CNN finally admits the existence of geoengineering, that it actually is happening. They're looking at doing atmospheric and weather manipulation, and there it is, boom. And there, and I have it posted up on my Facebook page. You can check out the article for yourself, listen to the CNN. There's about three articles that are kind of linked inside each other. And take a look for yourself. Geoengineering and the idea that man can control the weather is profoundly arrogant, in my opinion, and something that if it gets messed up, we could have some long-term consequences and unintended consequences that we couldn't possibly foresee. Also on the national front, and this coming from the Free Beacon, a great news source too. If you don't know about the Free Beacon, you can get their newsletters. But 30 GOP congressmen, they catalog this, have now, and congresswomen, have now been attacked or threatened since May. I'm going to say that again. 30 GOP congressmen and congresswomen have been either attacked or threatened since May. And this, from all indications, looking through that, coming from admitted leftists. Again, the violence coming from the left. Also on the national front, the first state-run gold depository to open here in Texas. Amazing. So their intent is to repatriate $1 billion in bullion stored in New York, offering Texans, quote, a safe place to park their precious metals closer to home, end quote. A story by Breitbart, a return to sound money by the state of Texas. Amazing story right there. On the regional front, court paperwork has revealed that the investigation of FBI agents in regards to the death of Lavoy Finicum down in Oregon are now before a grand jury. We don't know the results of that or where it's at, but the investigation is now before a grand jury. Now, folks, to get to a point like that, there has to be something. Now, if you don't recall this, what this entailed was the fact that I think it was five shell casings came up missing from the scene where Lavoy Finicum was shot. And Oregon State troopers literally said, hey, those things were removed, and pointed the finger at the FBI, according to statements that were released in several outlets earlier this year. So this investigation's continuing. We're going to, you know, as more facts come out, we'll continue to bring that forward, but before a grand jury right now, according to court paperwork. Also on the regional front, we're in the third special session. Some are calling it the super duper special session, trying to get the budget done down here in Olympia. A couple points. Capital budget. The capital budget is not required by law. It's different from the operating budget. And the capital budget right now, the negotiations there have stalled because the Democrats refuse to negotiate directly on Hearst and to solve Hearst in a way that is going to restore property rights throughout Washington state. That said, there were some overtures made this morning, and I understand negotiations are continuing into tomorrow morning, but right now, from all indications, my colleagues in the Republican caucus, we are holding strong on a full, complete Hearst fix. In other words, to allow you to develop your property, drill for water again, on your property, and get rid of this ridiculous ruling from the Washington State Supreme Court that essentially led to a moratorium, especially on building in Spokane County. So I know a lot of you have asked about the water update. That's where negotiations are right now, and I should have something more by Thursday to let you know what the final result of all these negotiations are. Also, a budget update. Negotiations continue for the budget. Looks like we might be able to vote on a budget as early as Friday, and there are a lot of things that are coming forward on that, including an internet tax. Some people call it marketplace fairness. It is an internet tax, and there are a lot of different things that are coming forward, and I know a lot of you have sent me emails in regards to that internet tax, and so from my discussions with people, there are a lot of people that are just absolutely against something like that. And I know as of right now, like Representative Dave Taylor, they've been in negotiations until late into the night. I believe 1 o'clock in the morning is when they finished up yesterday. So as that continues to go on, I will let you know probably Thursday what the results of that are as well. On the local front, there are more PDC violations from the Democrat Party that are going to be brought forward. This is across the state, but there's a couple of stories that are huge that will be breaking here in the next few days. But we need to keep your eye on that part of it too, because what you're seeing is just is unbelievable. The Attorney General now is filing suits in many of these cases. To the extent that his office is all this part of his office anyway is doing constant investigations on these PDC violations against Democrats across Washington State. So just a huge story there. Local front, we have local races for the Spokane Valley City Council, and it's interesting. I did some investigation, and now we have confirmed through several sources that indeed there is an unofficial progressive Reed Socialist slate that is running against the Spokane Valley City Council, the current sitting city council, the ones that have brought no new taxes, the ones that have brought budget surpluses every year, the ones that have reformed government in such a way as to save $16 million on one transportation project alone. They've drawn progressive opponents, and so those people are running against them, and I will be naming names because we have the sources that have confirmed this, and I just know that when you see somebody running against a Spokane Valley City Council person and you don't know who they are, you might want to do some digging because very likely they're a progressive. All right, lastly, this weekend, God and Country, Marble, Washington, which is up near Northport, the annual celebration, which brings the largest amount of patriots from around the state of Washington. Please come up there. Festivities kick off Friday night at 7 o'clock up there at Marble, and I look forward to seeing all of you there. And that's the briefing. Remember, the antidote to dependency and socialism is to be a God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving American. Thank you to everybody that has gone to the Patriot Radio Facebook page, liked it, and shared it with your friends and family. We are growing pretty big right now, and I just thank you all for that. Thank you also for your prayers. It's been a tumultuous 3 weeks for me and for Victoria as well, and thank you for all the well wishes and just everybody that has been there and shown their support for us. Well, I'm really excited today to introduce my guest, Robert Rucker. He's organizing, he's literally the organizer of the International Shroud of Turin Conference that is coming to Pasco, Washington this month. So, Robert, thanks for joining me on Patriot Radio today. I really look forward to this.
Well, I'm glad to join you.
So, first of all, tell all the listeners a little bit about who you are and tell them about the conference that's coming up. I'm super excited. This is actually going to be here in Washington State. I've been fascinated by the Shroud of Turin for a very long time.
Shroud of Turin is one fascinating object. I've been interested in it for about 50 years. I've been working on it full-time for about 3.5 years. My My background, I took a bachelor's and master's in nuclear engineering from University of Michigan, and I worked in the nuclear industry for about 38 years. I then applied the nuclear analysis computer codes that I would normally use in the industry to model the body in a cloth in a limestone tomb as it would have been designed in Jerusalem in the first century in order to explain the carbon-14 dating problem for the Shroud of Turin. I believe I've solved that problem, and that's part of the motivation for the conference that's coming up July 19th to the 22nd at the Track Center in Pasco, Washington. And we're going to have about 31 researchers from Italy, Spain, France, Australia, and the United States come to the conference, delivering at this point about 51 different presentations, PowerPoint presentations. We're going to have panel discussions. We're going to have items on display. And we hope to have hundreds of people in the big room at the Track Center.
Boy, I'm super excited about this. I have been following this for a very long time, so I kind of want to start from the basics. So listeners that aren't familiar with the Shroud of Turin, what is it, and what is a little bit about the history that we can know and prove about it to set the stage for what we're going to talk about here a little bit later in the program?
Yes, well, a shroud is a piece of cloth that a person is buried in. Turin is a city in northwestern Italy. Fiats are made there. The Olympics was there in 2006, I believe. So the Shroud of Turin refers to a particular burial cloth that's located in the cathedral in Turin, Italy. It's been in Turin since 1578, and it goes on display four, five, six times a century maybe. And whenever it does, you'll have 2 to 3 million people file past it, and they will see the image that's on this piece of cloth. This is a full-size front and back image of a naked crucified man that was crucified exactly as the Bible describes that Jesus was crucified. So the question is, could this possibly be the authentic burial cloth of Jesus, as ancient tradition claims?
So what do we know so far about the history of where it came from? So if it was indeed the burial cloth,
yes,
of Jesus Christ, where did it come from? Why did it suddenly reappear in the 1500s instead of earlier than that? Or what is the history that we know so far?
Okay, well, Eusebius, I'm holding a copy of Eusebius, a historian, wrote a book called The History of the Church about 325, and he said that a disciple named Thaddeus took the burial cloth of Jesus from Jerusalem up to Edessa, Turkey, where it was called the Image of Edessa. It apparently stayed there until 944 A.D., when the political leader in Constantinople sent his army over to take possession of it, which he did, and they carried it to Constantinople in 944. And it was celebrated there, and the image from the Shroud of Turin was on different paintings. It was on different artwork. It was on different coins. Matter of fact, I always carry a coin minted in Byzantium, that's what they used to call Constantinople, in 1025 to 1028, which shows the image from the Shroud of Turin on it. And the Shroud of Turin, this what we now call the Shroud of Turin, evidently stayed in Constantinople until 1204, when it was apparently stolen in the Fourth Crusade. It went underground for about 150 years and resurfaced about 1355, 1356 in northern France, being shown in a little town of Lyrie, France, as the burial cloth of Jesus, gradually made its way across France, and then arrived in Turin, Italy in 1578. So I would connect this from Jerusalem to Edessa, Turkey, to Constantinople, to Lyrie, France, to Turin, Italy, where it is today. So that's a brief outline of the history.
All right, so let's talk first about the dating that proves that this could actually come from the era of Jesus Christ. How is it dated? What are the current dating methodologies that are used, without getting obviously too technical? And how confident are you that it can be dated to that era?
Okay, there's various different ways which indicate that this is prior to the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages is the other option because it surfaced in northern France in 1355, and that would be consistent with the carbon-14 dating of it. But there are multiple indications that the carbon-14 dating is not correct, and that the image on the cloth actually dates to hundreds and hundreds of years prior to the carbon-14 date. For example, the carbon-14 date was dated to 1260 to 1390 A.D., yet my coin with the image from the Shroud of Turin on it dates to 1025 to 1028, which is 235 years earlier than the carbon-14 dating, so that really raises the question, how could the carbon dating be so wrong? Which is a very interesting question in itself. Now, the ways in which it can be dated, which indicate that it's much earlier than the Middle Ages, the image is on hand-spun linen made from the flax plant. Well, the spinning wheel was invented somewhere around the 10th century, so that would put this piece of cloth prior to the 10th century. The size of this piece of cloth is 14.5 feet long, 3.5 feet wide. But in the ancient times, they didn't use feet, they used cubits. What's interesting, this turns out to be almost exactly 8 by 2 cubits. So that in and of itself dates it to far earlier than the Middle Ages. There is a little strip about 3 inches wide on this piece of cloth, which was evidently cut off and then sewn back on in the manufacturing process. And the stitch that it was sewn back on with has only shown up one other location, and that's at Masada, which was destroyed in 73 to 74 A.D. So that stitch would date this to the first century. There is some evidence that over one eye there is a coin that has been identified as a Roman lepton minted by Pontius Pilate between 29 and 32 A.D., that shows up on one photograph. That needs to be confirmed on other photographs, though. So there's a variety of different types of dating techniques. More recent dating techniques based upon the tensile strength of linen and the reflectivity of linen has dated it to the first century, so that all of those dating techniques are consistent with the burial cloth being that of Jesus, except for carbon dating. Carbon dating is the outlier here. So we need to look very closely as to what would cause the carbon dating to be so wrong. And I believe I've solved that.
Yeah, that would be my next question. What has, I mean, why would it be so wrong?
Okay, well, let me give you a little bit more background on the nature of the image here. This image is a straw yellow discoloration, and that discoloration on a linen thread, there's about 100 to 200 fibers in a thread, and that straw yellow discoloration is only on the top one or two layers of fibers. That can't be produced by a human being. Then when they looked at an individual fiber, which would be about 15 to 20 microns, millionths of a meter in diameter, they found that the discoloration is 360 degrees around, but only less than 0.4 microns, less than a wavelength of light. That's the thickness of the discoloration. That can't be formed by a human being. No forger or artist could form that. Thirdly, the discoloration is now known to exist because in the carbon atoms that were in the cellulose molecule from the flax plant, that carbon atom would have 2 electrons in the inner orbit, 4 electrons in the outer orbit. So those 4 outer electrons would single bond with individual atoms, 4 different individual atoms around it. But in this image where it's discolored with a straw yellow discoloration, those single covalent bonds, some of them have been changed into double covalent bonds. Extremely bizarre. Now, no human being could do that. This is simply outside of our understanding of the laws of physics and science. So that's where we have to go with this. Whatever caused this image is outside of our understanding of the physics of science. And so that where we arrive at when we take a look at all these individual pieces of evidence and follow the evidence where it leads without being restricted or constrained by a presupposition of naturalism, what we end up with is that the best explanation for this type of discoloration, where it's located and what's causing it, is a burst of radiation being emitted from within the body. That burst of radiation had to come from within the body because there are bones that show up on this image. So that radiation had to carry the information content from the bones inside the body to the cloth and deposit that information on the cloth to form the image of those bones on the cloth. Isn't that amazing? So that there's about six different ways you can transport information, but you can exclude five of those for the shroud. There's only one that you can't exclude, and that is radiation. So that when we look at a scene out in front of us, all of the information content is being transported to our eyes by reflected photons, which is radiation. And that's the only thing that could transport the information content from the body to the cloth to control the discoloration mechanism to form the image. And if we also investigate the possibility that there were also neutrons in this radiation burst that caused the image, then what we realize is that an assumption that that neutrons were included in that radiation burst, it explains the four things that we know about the carbon dating and the Shroud of Turin. It explains the date to 1260 AD. It explains why the three different laboratories didn't agree well with each other. It explains the distribution of dates across the samples, and it actually explains the date of another piece of cloth in the Bible called the face cloth or head cloth that was wrapped or folded up separate from the body cloth, but it was dated to 700 AD by carbon dating. And in my nuclear analysis computer calculations, when I model cloth on either the left or the right bench with a person working, doing the burial at the head of the pit area in the tomb, he'd take the face cloth off the face, and if he was right-handed, which most people are, he would probably just lay it just parallel with his body on the right side bench. And that's exactly where, in my nuclear analysis computer calculations, the date of a piece of cloth that was manufactured in the first century due to neutron absorption would date to 700 AD, exactly how the face cloth was dated. The common term for that is the Sudarium of Oviedo, because it's located in Oviedo, Spain. And the history on that piece of cloth is fairly well known.
So with that, because that gets very, very complicated, and I know there's some technical details there, but you are very confident that the Shroud of Turin is dated to the first century AD.
I think if you simply follow the evidence where it leads, then that's the only reasonable explanation. I don't think there's any other rational explanation for what we see on the shroud. This cannot be the result of any human process or human hand. It simply cannot. It has to be something that's outside of our understanding of the laws of physics and science. Because you go look in your closet and in your dresser, and none of your clothing will show a high-resolution image made by your body on the inside of any of your clothing. Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting. Well, this is Matt Shea on Patriot Radio with Robert Rucker, the organizer of the International Shroud of Turin Conference, coming to Pasco, Washington here later this month. Robert, I want to continue down this road because this is absolutely... just absolutely fascinating. Now, I know that there have been 3D imaging simulations done. What do those 3D images tell us about the shroud? And is there any other insight that you can add that maybe listeners haven't heard about new discoveries about the shroud?
Well, the researchers that are coming here, they're coming basically two reasons. One is to deliver all their most recent research, but also kind of put all the pieces together on what we know about the Shroud in order to help educate the layman on this topic. This has got to be one of the most mysterious items in human possession. Matter of fact, it is the most researched ancient artifact in human possession. It's been scientifically investigated since 1898. Well, I mean, this is just absolutely fascinating, and I think we've come to some realizations here that will help us to understand these various mysteries, why we can see an image on the cloth, and why it is an image of a naked crucified man that was crucified exactly as Jesus was crucified, and how that image was encoded onto the cloth, why the carbon dating was so wrong. I think we can start to understand all these things.
Let's talk a little bit about the image itself. What specifically is seen in the image that leads you to the statement to say that this is an image of someone that was crucified just as Jesus was? What is in the image that has either been modeled or can be seen that would lead you to that conclusion?
Oh, yes. Well, right now in my hand, I have a copy of National Geographic from June of 1980, and you can still get these. They're about a dollar on the internet with shipping added to it. But there's a section here on the Shroud of Turin. This is a four-page foldout, and it shows a beautiful foldout copy here. The front and back image of the naked crucified body that was wrapped within this piece of cloth, and it shows the face. Now, I might just mention here, most of us have an idea of what Jesus looked like. It's kind of been handed down in our culture. Where did that idea come from? Well, you trace it back with all the paintings and everything. It traces back to the 6th and 7th century when the artists started drawing pictures like we think of Jesus today. Why were they drawing it like that at that time? Because the Shroud of Turin was rediscovered in a niche above a gate in the wall of Edessa, Turkey, where it had evidently been hidden to avoid persecution and destruction. So our concept of what Jesus looked like is we derive it from the Shroud of Turin and the image that the painters could see. They would go to Edessa, Turkey to paint what Jesus looked like. Very fascinating. But on this image, it shows the hair coming down on either side. It shows a man with a mustache and with a beard, with a little notch pulled out of the center of the bottom of the beard. It shows a long nose. It shows the face directly looking directly at you. It shows rather large light spots for the eyes. The nose looks swollen as though it could have been either bruised or broken, either by being hit or in a fall. It shows one cheek that's swollen. It shows the blood from various puncture wounds on the front and back of the head. This blood has been tested. It is AB. Some evidence it's AB positive in blood type. It is male. They found both male and female chromosomes in it. Most distinctively, though, it's high in a compound called bilirubin, and bilirubin is a compound that's made by the liver when it processes damaged red blood cells, as when a person is nearly beat to death, which Jesus was in the flogging. Now, no forger would know to put bilirubin into the blood. No artist would from the Middle Ages. This indicates that it's the authentic burial cloth of Jesus. Now, there's pollen up around the head, pollen from a plant with long thorns on it. There is pollen on the shroud from many different locations indicating its history, but there is pollen that is unique to Jerusalem on this cloth. No forger would know to do that. At the feet, there's a little globule of dirt, and in this dirt, there's a little fleck of limestone. This limestone can be identified by the impurities in it. This limestone is called Jerusalem limestone. All this is a strong indication that we really do have the authentic burial cloth here of Jesus. You can see the arms coming down folded in front of his groin. The One indication here that this is the authentic burial cloth of Jesus and not from the Middle Ages is that the nail did not go through the palm, because experiments have been done, and a nail through the palm, because there's no bones above it, will only support 62 pounds, which is not enough to support 170 to 175-pound person. It had to go through the wrist. There is a location in the wrist where a nail or spike could be put in without breaking any bones. And archaeologically, we do have evidence that that is where they put spikes in Roman crucifixion. And what they did not know, now the point here is that in the Middle Ages, all the paintings showed the spike going through the palm of the hand. So therefore, the Shroud of Turin, which I'm looking at in National Geographic, June 1980, it shows the blood coming from the wrist, not the palms. Therefore, this is not a product from the Middle Ages. Also, what they didn't know in the Middle Ages was that when that spike would go through the wrist, because there's a nerve that collects all the feelings from all the fingers that runs right past that location, it automatically folds the thumbs over. They didn't know that in the Middle Ages. All the paintings in the Middle Ages prominently show the thumbs. The Shroud of Turin does not, consistent with the real burial cloth of Jesus and what would have happened with the spike going through the wrist. Now, the blood running down the arms is at the angles for with the arms up for crucifixion. As a matter of fact, we now know that in crucifixion, one foot had two nails through it, the other had only one, so that the person could go up and down, in order to breathe on the cross while being crucified, so that his pain was extended. But in the process of going up and down, there's actually two different angles that the arms go into. And those two different angles can be seen in the pattern of blood on the arms. All this is too amazing to be just a forgery from the Middle Ages. That's not rational.
That is absolutely fascinating. Now, in the few minutes that we've got left, we've only got about 3 minutes left, could you tell the listeners, if they want to attend the conference, where can they go get more information? How can they sign up? And again, what dates and where is it at?
Yes, it's at the very large track facility in Pasco, Washington, and the dates are July 19th to the 22nd. Please go to the website, shroudresearch.net. That's Shroud, S-H-R-O-U-D, shroudresearch.net. And there is one page there with a drop-down menu, tells you all about the conference that's coming up. This is going to be a turning point in Shroud research.
I want to conclude by just asking you the implications of the Shroud being real from your own personal perspective.
Okay, I'll take off my science hat. I'll put on my Christian believer's hat here. What we have here is the authentic burial cloth of Jesus. It bears scientific testimony to the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, because a burst of radiation, including neutrons, does not come from any ordinary person, whether dead or alive. So this bears testimony to the resurrection of Jesus. It is the visual testimony to the gospel, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. It is God's receipt to us, to humanity, for a finished transaction, because it shows where our salvation came from and the price that was paid.
This is just one of the most fascinating subjects, one of the most fascinating guests I've had on here. I really appreciate everything that you're doing, Robert. I want to have you back on again, too. And I just hope that everybody listening to the show right now throughout all of eastern Washington, North Idaho, and parts of western Montana actually show up down there, because this is going to be one of those things you will remember for the rest of your life. Just absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Robert, for everything that you're doing. And if there's anything I can help you to do to get the word out about this, I would love to help you do it.
Well, thank you for having me on.
All right. Robert Rucker, the organizer of the Shroud of Turin Conference, coming to Tri-Cities here on the 19th of July to the Track Center. That's that big, gigantic center right next to the freeway. You can see it from the freeway. This is just, it is just amazing. And here yet again, we have one of these great proofs of Christianity. And I think that's, like he said, I think that's one of the most profound parts of this entire thing. that if the shroud is authentic, if it dates from the first century, if it does show a burst of radiation that colored the cloth, and if it is consistent with the descriptions, the written descriptions that we have of how Jesus Christ was crucified, then it brings up a very interesting question. If Jesus Christ was a living human being, which by all historical and extant records, and also the shroud, he was, and he is, then specifically non-believers, but also us as believers, we have to deal with the fact that God came to earth in human form to die for us on the cross so that our sins might be forgiven and we might have eternal life. And that if we repent and we put our faith in him, that we can have that eternal life and that our life will be profoundly changed thereafter. And this is just one more testimony, one more witness to that life. And some people say, well, you know, if God's up there, I've heard this from non-believers, if God's up there, why doesn't he show me he's real? Well, here's the Shroud of Turin and all of the other witness accounts that are out there. And, you know, The Case for Christ, written by Lee Strobel, now a movie that's out there showing the evidence, showing fact after fact after fact. And the ultimate thing is, instead of avoiding the question, I think that we need to bring this question to non-believers and force them to confront that question. If Jesus Christ was real and he was God, then what do I do with my life? God bless you all.